Well, the All-Star break has come and essentially gone, and there's a lot to talk about now that we're through the home run derby, through the All-Star break, and rolling quickly to the trade deadline. Parker, how are you feeling today?
Feeling good, man. The All-Star break functions as kind of like sort of a break from baseball for me as well, on top of my normal habitual, just obsessive consumption of the game at a cyclic rate during the season. So when the All-Star break rolls around and content kind of slows down, there's no games being played, there's no fresh storylines for a couple days, I think we actually do get a pretty solid chance to unwind a bit. And we're recording on the day before baseball comes back, so we're on the end of the All-Star break. We have kind of made it through the dry spell. Everybody's teams are rested, and I'm super excited to see what happens tomorrow, because in particular, my team is in an interesting spot right now with the schedule they just played, the games they've just won, and the teams that are coming up.
Yeah, it will be interesting. We'll spend some time here a little bit talking about what we're looking forward to as we get to the end of July here, what teams will be movers and shakers here in the coming weeks. Before we do that, though, Parker, man, it was All-Star break never has its dull moments, and certainly didn't over the past week. And a lot of stuff happened over the last couple of days. And despite the fact that we're talking about this break happening, it was everything but, seemingly.
Yeah.
I want to start with the All-Star selections, because I feel like the 3 days leading up to All-Star break, everyone was abuzz about Jacob Mizorowski making the All-Star team. He's only, pitched in six starts. He hasn't been in the league long enough. You know, the complaints just ran rampant. What did you make of Jacob Mizorowski making his appearance in the All-Star game this year?
So I understand, and I actually felt and really resonated with the general sentiment of, like, really, this guy's in the All-Star team when he was first announced. That was my first reaction. And then I got to thinking, especially in the wake of, like, Nick Castellanos' comments that this is becoming like the Savannah Bananas and they're just inviting people because they would be fun to have. And my first thought was, yeah, tell him, Nick. And then I thought, wait a minute. This is nothing but good for the game. Like, this is really what I want baseball to be doing. Like, there is this incredibly compelling, super cool young pitcher that has electric stuff. And I know we say this all the time, but kind of really that we haven't seen before, like, in the way that he throws it. And that's what makes pitching so unique. Like, even Paul Skenes' stuff that we were talking about 2 years ago is not as surprising, in my opinion, as this. Like, he had his 100-mile-an-hour splinker, and that, like, broke the world, and everyone was like, how is he even throwing this pitch? Jacob Mizorowski's throwing, like, 98-mile curveballs. And it's like, wow, this is a super interesting person. And yeah, I want that guy in the main stage. Yeah, there are people watching the All-Star game that don't typically watch every game like you and I do. And I think that that's super important to include in the game. Okay, if Clayton Kershaw can be in the game based solely on past achievement, then Jacob Mizorowski getting into the All-Star game because he was so dominant in the only five starts he got, but the only reason he only got those five starts is because, if we're being completely honest, the Brewers manipulated his service time. I think that that's something super interesting to bring up and talk about all the time.
Yeah, I'm with you in a lot of respects there. I mean, no doubt about it. It's fun for the game, right? I mean, they're at a point where they're going to put their younger stars out there, and they want people to have eyes on those stars. Don't blame them at all for that. I think on the other side of it, I understand where the players are coming from, because of the fact that there were, I believe, 12 or 13 pitchers that rejected being included in the All-Star festivities before they even went to Jacob Mizorowski, which justifies
it more.
Right. Well, I don't know. I go back and forth. Does it justify it more? Yeah, probably. But the other half of me is like, reject the All-Star. Do people not care about it? Is it not prestigious enough? Have players fallen out of favor with the concept of an All-Star game and making an All-Star team? Like you kind of talked about it earlier, right? Clayton Kershaw making it off of his career achievements. That's different. That's still based on off of achievements. But maybe there's a conversation to be had about how serious do players really even take the All-Star game to begin with.
Sort of. I can agree with you to a certain extent, But I don't. So think about this. How many of these same 12 pitchers would turn down the World Baseball Classic if offered? I would wager almost all of them, or at least a sizable chunk of them. And I think it's because Major League Baseball players are in the game to do two things. Number one is to win a World Series. And honestly, it's like 1A and 1B between that and make money enough to support themselves and their families for the rest of their lives. And especially with pitchers, and especially in today's and this over the course of the last couple years climate when it comes to pitching, I totally understand the decision to just decide, why would I put innings on my arm that I do not need to put on it? Totally get that. So I think that it's more born out of a desire to stay healthy, help your team win. And think about it. Like, if these are pitchers that are being offered All-Star game spots, they're probably on contending teams, because it's kind of how it swings in terms of All-Star selections.
Yeah.
And if you're contending and you're a pitcher and you pitched 2 days ago, you're talking about like kind of throwing your midweek bullpen in the middle of a game against some of the best hitters in baseball. Maybe you only get 9 pitches in. You're getting up, getting warmed up, and sitting down after like 9 to 12 pitches. That's just not a full bullpen. You're really talking about damage to their arms. So I'm willing to give Major League Baseball and even those 12 pitchers the benefit of the doubt in terms of like, okay, none of these guys want to pitch in the All-Star game. I understand that sentiment and I respect it. And I also respect the sentiment of Major League Baseball being like, you know who would really love to pitch in an All-Star game? A guy who's only made 6 starts, and a guy who could really go out into the Major League Baseball All-Star game and on a national stage make a name for himself. And really, he did. Like, this stuff he was putting out there during the All-Star game was electric, and it was so fun to see. It's like watching a kid in a candy store. He just fulfilled a lifelong dream, and I think it was super cool. And to see the reactions, like, he threw like that 98 mile an hour curveball that I saw on Pitching Ninja today on Twitter, and both dugouts were in awe. The National League was laughing because he's on their team, and the American League was almost like, what the fuck are we dealing with right now? Like, why is this guy out here? He shouldn't be out here. He's out here slicing and dicing. So I think it was almost like a super cathartic moment, and got a bunch of closure from the fact that he went out there and was nails. I like it. I came around to it. I was not initially on board with it, and I think I really came around to the idea of like, yeah, this is a showcase. Let's treat it as
Home Run Derby. Parker was the great show that it always was. I mean, I had now, strong feelings about who we wanted to see and all the moonshots, but I'm kind of surprised at how it all played out, not going to lie.
Mm-hmm. So I love the Home Run Derby. It is my favorite part of All-Star Weekend. I did my classic move that I always do every year, where I watched every single pitch of the Home Run Derby, and then I caught the highlights after the All-Star game was over.
Yep.
To me, the All-Star or the Home Run Derby is appointment television, and the All-Star game really isn't. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. And while I did love the product that was on the field for the Home Run Derby, I think that we have reached the weakest version of the timer-based format that we've had since its inception. I think that by limiting pitches, we have pigeonholed ourselves into only a certain number of home runs being able to be hit, because human error is a factor. I texted this to you, and I don't know if I will die on this hill, but I think that the consideration for pitching machines should be made, because a lot of these hitters are losing pitches and time to bad pitches. And that was not a factor. And the reason we had human pitchers, because it wasn't a factor when there was outs. When you had 10 outs and every swing that wasn't a home run is an out, I think that was super acceptable to have a human pitcher out there that can make error or make, you know, is subject to human error and doesn't need to be perfect every time. But when you see like the contrast, remember when Julio Rodriguez hit like 175 home runs in a round or whatever it was, and his pitcher was nails, like found the spot and hit that spot every single pitch for basically the entire round. And then you look at a player like Cal Raleigh ran into trouble with his dad not being able to find spots at certain points in the Derby. And when you're down to the wire, like Cal Raleigh was at several points during this tournament, it starts to really show the weaknesses of the format. And I don't think that in an event that is as prestigious, it is, in my opinion, the most prestigious All-Star Weekend event in major American sports. I don't think that it should come down to the pitcher being the determining factor. And I do think the pitcher had a significant amount of influence on the outcome of this home run derby.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And that's not even to mention something you and I were talking about during the derby over text was you and I didn't even know what the rules were. Like we couldn't even tell you coming into this what the rules were to the derby because they change every year. And so I don't
every
that
year.
In itself isn't even consistent. And I'm shocked every time they pop up these rules and I'm like, oh, I didn't even know they changed. I don't know how I feel about that. I do love the idea of taking the picture of it. I love the idea of having it off the machine. I mean, guys, this is a home run derby here. Let's just use the machine. It's not a big deal. But I don't know. We'll say this. Like, I don't know how you solve for this, but, and I don't mean to throw shade on the guy, but like someone like Jazz Chisholm don't really care to see in a home run derby. Like, I don't mean to be that guy.
I
but
do.
Like,
see, that's the thing. I do.
Really?
I think Jazz Chisholm is one of the more electric players in Major League Baseball. And I don't mind that he only hit three home runs. The first home run derby was won with six home runs by Dave Parker. May he rest in peace. But Jazz Chisholm coming out afterwards and saying that I'm not going to screw up my swing and making excuses afterward, that is Bush League, man. You know, that is so disappointing for me to hear.
That's
a guy
true.
Who really
That's
is looked up to by a lot of young people in this game and was the Yankee representative. And say what you will, that means something in an event like this. Being the Yankee in that lineup and being representative of the team that's coaching staff and manager was in the dugout for the All-Star game. I just don't think that making comments like that afterward was really great. I'm fine with you hitting three home runs, dude. Like Mookie Betts came out and had a really terrible showing in recent years. And it's like nobody held it against him because he didn't say any dumb shit afterwards. And I think to just pawn it off was super Bush League, in my opinion.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I'll tell you what, though. The young guys really showed up. You know, you're thinking about guys like James Woods, O'Neill Cruz.
Junior
Caminero. Yeah, totally. Wow, shame on me for not mentioning him first because he was by far the most impressive. I mean, you wanted moonshots. I mean, these younger guys delivered them. And it makes me excited. I mean, this is... You look at a guy like Junior Caminero, and I kind of relate it to Mizorowski. You know, he's one of those guys that if you ask any casual baseball fan, they probably have never heard of this guy. So good for him for getting on that stage, absolutely crushing the ball, you know, making it as far as he did.
With
that's
easy
big.
Power,
for the race.
Easy swings.
Easy
like
power.
It was effortless.
Easy. Well, and that's, I said the same thing about like a Brent Rooker, right? I said like the
oh
fact
my God,
that
he, was
he
so
swings
good.
The bat and it's like, elastic off the bat immediately. I just don't understand how just calm his swing looks and how electric it is off the bat. Speaking of Brent Rooker, you mentioned something about some drama around the home run derby and Brent Rooker, and I admittingly had not heard of this. So what happened?
So I'm going to start. There's two things I do want to address with the Brent Rooker situation in the home run derby. I'm going to start with the thing that everybody's kind of up in arms about on Twitter, and it is the fact that him and Cal Raleigh were tied in the second round. They tied the same amount of home runs, and apparently, and again, this is bad on Major League Baseball's part. We didn't know this, but the tiebreaker when it comes to a tied round is longest home. And this is the home run derby, and I'm super down for it being the longest homer.
Yeah.
In concept. But when it played out in front of us, it turned out that Cal Raleigh hit a ball 800ths of a foot further than Brent Rooker. And that's within the margin of error for StatCast. And look, I'm a StatCast guy. It is very, very accurate. If you watch like StatCast, I challenge people to look and see at StatCast readings and mark them against landmarks on the baseball field that are actually like, you know, set in stone in their distance. So things like second base and the pitcher's mound and first base, they're all set distances. Bases are 90 feet apart. It's 120 feet to second base from the home plate. It's 60 feet, 6 inches to the rent mound. I've seen people on TrackMan, which TrackMan is the software behind StatCast in a lot of areas. It's a lot of cameras and it's TrackMan. I've seen balls that were placed at 61 feet of distance that landed 6 inches behind the rubber. And it's like, wow, this is super accurate. So I am okay with using StatCast to break ties. But I think that if you have a ball that landed inside the same like 1 foot margin of error, you should probably have a swing off, a three swing swing off to determine who won that round. And it, like that seems like the natural progression. If the whole point of the event is to excite people and get to see home runs being hit and Brent Rooker and Cal Raleigh are tied, let's have a three swing swing off to see who moves on. It's like a mini little finals round right in the middle of the home run derby. So I do feel bad for Brent Rooker in that sense. And I'll get to the other thing here in a second, but I am curious as to your thoughts as of using StatCast in that way.
It just seems like an odd application for it. I had to agree with you. Like I think about it this way. These balls are landing in the bleachers, hitting fans, right? I mean, how do you accurately even capture that in the first place? I mean, we're talking about, Parker, the difference between me missing my cup holder and my drink falling on the ground sitting in my seat. Like, I mean, come on. We're talking about these minuscule distances, and I don't know how entirely reliable it is, but also, like you said, how you kind of split hairs at that point when it's less than a foot apart.
And I do want to address something that came up online and in interactions about this type of stuff. And people are saying that, you know, TrackMan is not based on like the conditions on the field at the time. It makes a calculation based on exit velocity, launch angle, swing path, things like that. And it projects the landing spot. And it's very accurate. And a lot of people were in the replies saying, you know, it doesn't take into account wind or humidity. And I'm going to be completely honest, I don't fucking want wind to be the determining factor in that situation. Like, I don't want Brent Rooker to happen to catch breeze and that's what puts him in front of Cal Raleigh. I would rather have a more neutral measurement, but I agree. I don't think that that should have been used in that particular instance to determine the winner. There was one other thing I wanted to bring up about Brent Rooker, and this is honestly something that I think he has a much larger argument as to how he was unfairly treated. There was another point in time, I think it might have been the same round, it might have been the first round, I don't remember, but so what was happening was you got a number of warm-up pitches, and by warm-up I mean the pitcher's warming up their arm, but also the hitter is getting used to seeing the ball, especially when we get to like the magenta ball rounds. It's like, okay, you can barely see this damn thing. But what happened was you got a limited amount of pitches during the round. You got 40 pitches, which we already talked about. I'm not a huge fan of it to begin with. But the pitcher that was pitching to Brent Rooker, they set the black bag of baseballs down into the little cage thing that he was pulling from. And then the round had not started. Brent was still allowed to get his warm-up pitches. And he asked for two warm-up pitches, and the pitcher threw two balls. The round started, and then we get down to about 8 or 9 seconds left in the round, and Brent Rooker only had 38 balls in the bag. So he had two pitches and time on the clock left, and then he ended up tying that round. And so
don't love that,
especially with a guy. There were moments in that round where he was just automatic, and he was, especially towards the end where those pitches would have been thrown, where the pitcher had really found a zone. Brent was really finding his swing, and the ball was just flying out of the yard. And to lose those two pitches is super, super disappointing. Like, especially for a guy that looked like he was going to make a kind of a dark horse run at the beginning of the first round and second round. Really, he looked like he was making a dark horse run for this home run derby. He came, he meant business.
Yeah, I mean, that there's definitely an argument to be made there. That's a huge bummer for Rooker. You hate to see that. Those two pitches could have been the real difference there. I believe I did notice that, too, because at the end, they replaced the balls, and they ran out pretty quick. I was surprised by how fast they ran out.
Yeah, and you know what? Huh. The fact that we're running out of pitches, I just don't like the pitch limit. No. Like, especially because every home run derby I go back and I'm watching highlights of old home run derbies, and I'm watching like Josh Hamilton's huge round that he had back when it was 10 outs and you got unlimited pitches. And then you see how fruitful that model is in contrast directly during the round when we have the magenta like bonus round with three or four outs, depending on how far you hit your home runs. And you could see how the game slowed down to a really dramatic pace. And like, especially when a player would finish the swing, like the fast swing round, the 40 pitch round with, you know, just less than or maybe tied with the person that they were battling in that particular part of the tournament. And we get to the magenta ball round. It's like you have four outs. can you hit 5 home runs? It's like, oh man, this is drama. And I like the combination of the two. I actually love the idea of like a 2-minute round, 3-minute round of unlimited pitches followed by the slow paced magenta round. I think that that's kind of the sweet spot here, but it just sucks that we had a pitch limit. I really do not like the pitch limit because there were several times where players were going on rolls and they just came to a screeching halt with 15 seconds left in the round because there was no pitches left.
No, yeah, I don't like the pitch limit whatsoever. I would take the 10 out format in a heartbeat. Like, give me that, right? Like, I want to see guys go on like a 10 home run streak run in the middle of their round with 6 outs, right? Like, I mean, do that or do the strictly the time limit of 2 or 3 minutes, 5 magenta balls, whatever. Yeah. It's got to be one of those.
Yeah, I loved the fact that we kind of got the best of both worlds we got the most of the best of both worlds, right? Like we got a pitch limited timed round, which I think is also electric to a certain extent, like the Vladdy round where he was just knocking balls into the stands and he had seconds ticking off the clock and he had like 2 or 3 homers in the air at a time. I think that was super cool a few years back at Coors, but like to limit it by pitches, I think was just kind of taking the best part of that format and put it in a corner.
For sure. Parker, I want to talk about the biggest thing that came out of this All-Star break, and it came out of the All-Star game, and it was Home Run Derby-esque. It was the swing-off at the end of the Home Run Derby where they decided
end of the All-Star game
off. Or yes, end of the All-Star game, they had a home run swing-off. Parker, this has been all the buzz the last 48 hours. What did you make of that?
I am 100% sold. I think this is... So, okay, I don't want to get rid of extra innings. And I think in the playoffs, traditional extra innings should happen. I think that that's super... I think that's super cool. But I think during the regular season, maybe we limit to like 3 extra innings. No ghost runner. No ghost runner. No ghost runner, 3 extra innings. You play maximum of 12 innings, and then you go to a swing off where it's like, okay, here's why I think this is perfect. Because remember when we had this huge uproar about the golden batter rule and we were like, oh, this is dumb. Why would you ever want this? Feels like the golden batter. That's what it felt like to me because the managers came out, got on the mic and announced who their 3 guys were. And Aaron Boone fucking punted it into the stands, man. Like, I cannot believe the lineup that he put out there. Brent Rooker, all about it. What the fuck was going through your head with the rest of those guys? Aranda, that's our guy. That's who's going to win the fucking All-Star game for the No, that was never going to happen. And I know he hadn't been in the game yet, but it's not Little League. You're an All-Star. You get to put it in your fucking contract negotiation. The fact that the 3 for the American League was not like Cal Raleigh, Aaron Judge, and maybe even Brent Rooker. Like, I'm okay with that being the 3 guys. But like, the electricity of the swing off and the fact that Kyle Schwarber goes out there and goes 3 for 3 to catch up with and then surpass the score of the American League, like, that was electric. And I think there's a place for it in the game. Genuinely think there's a place for it in the game, or maybe even in just the most specialized of circumstances. Like, maybe it's a doubleheader and only doubleheaders games are decided at this point. Like, you play 9 innings and then because it's a doubleheader and we're not trying to be here all damn day, we go to a swing off or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I didn't think about kind of doing the swing off with some form of extra innings. That's actually a really solid idea. It works well in hockey, right? You get overtime and then you get some shootout, right? So I love the way it is in hockey, quite frankly. I do love that format a lot. So I could see a scenario where it is 2 or 3 extra innings and a swing off only in the regular season. Because I will say, as I've been, this is going to sound so strange, whether it is in a real life game or even when I'm playing like freaking MLB The Show and I'm in extras, man. And it's like, I still have the ghost or the Manfred runner, whatever you want to call it, at second. And I cannot win this game. And I'm going 12, 13 innings. And in real life, even some of these games still go 10, 11 innings. There's an inherent advantage when you're the away team in those extra innings, right? I mean, when you can score 1 and all you have to do is get 3 outs, right? Like, I don't know that I'm even sold on how it works now, if I'm being honest. So I'm open to anything.
Yeah, because, you know, the advantage you're talking about in extra innings with the Ghost Runner is that the home team has to use their closer in that first extra inning. Or their highest leverage arm, because you are selling out for the fact that you can get three outs, sacrifice the guy to third, and sac fly him in or something like that. Mm-hmm. Once you actually get it to the plate. Whereas the away team has the benefit of planning around their already over offensive performance. And I completely agree. I think that you take away the Ghost Runner, you play three innings of traditional big league baseball, and you play three innings of, you know, extras, and you get to the 12th. We're still tied at the 12th. That was your sudden death overtime, just like in hockey. And now we're going to a swing off, which is the shootout. I think it's perfect. I think that's what soccer does. That's what hockey does. Yeah. The NFL can't fucking figure out overtime, so that's a terrible place to look for any sort of guidance on that matter. But no, I think there's a place for that. And I don't think Manfred's at the place right now where he's ever going to consider doing that, because he's on his way out the door and he's really only focused on the next CBA negotiation before he, you know, hangs up the spikes or whatever we want to call it for commissioners. But I think there's a place for it. I think there could be a place for it. And like, maybe you practice that or use it in spring training games, or even in like the WBC to try it out. I think that would be super cool.
Or if we really mix it up, we can, in those three innings, any foul ball that's hit, whichever fan of the team catches the ball in the stands automatically wins the game. Ultimate home field advantage.
I am so I think it's so funny that Castellanos said that it was basically banana ball, because
that's quite the stretch, buddy.
I don't even, you know what, even if it's not, let's pretend that it's not a stretch for a second, because it is, it's a stretch. But even if it wasn't a stretch, you could have come up with a more damning thing to call MLB, because likening the biggest exhibition event in Major League Baseball's regular season that happens every year outside of, I would say, the WBC, likening it to the most impressive baseball exhibition event in history is... Yeah. Not a way to get me to not like it. You know what?
That's
right. Let's make a banana ball game a part of All-Star Weekend. Let's do like an MLB All-Star team versus the bananas, and then the other MLB All-Star team versus the party animals or something like that at some point in the All-Star Week.
That's a great point. And but at the risk of going off on a whole Savannah Bananas tangent here, you bring up the point in that you can't really shit on the Savannah Bananas when they are objectively a more entertaining, oh, dare I say this, a more entertaining product that draws more than the MLB event to event.
On a per game basis, they are absolutely more compelling than a Major League Baseball game.
Yes. Which kind of pains me to say that, but the facts are the facts, right?
So like, and what is this but event to event when we're talking about the All-Star game that happens once a year? It is the ultimate in get all of the butts in the seats for one game. And look, I know the All-Star game sells out and I know tickets aren't the thing, but you know what would be off the charts? Viewership. TV viewership would be insane if you incorporated banana stuff into that type of event.
You know what's all? Who's also feeling seats? And again, I don't mean to, I'm like totally going in a different direction here. AUSL, man, they're filling ballparks, man. They are filling ballparks. And I don't know what it is for MLB. Like, is it, I don't know that it's the product as much anymore. I think, are people getting priced out? I think maybe that's a little bit of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know.
As a Red Sox fan, I'll tell you, yeah. Yeah, man.
I'm getting priced out more than the other 29 teams.
Dude, it is so expensive to go to a damn Red Sox game.
Hey, we gotta maintain that historical landmark status, man. That costs money.
Yeah, it does. And it's also the reason why the bullpens in Fenway have like bathrooms smaller than Garrett Crochet.
Well, you know, you need money to pay $30 million for a DH / first baseman / third. Wait,
not paying him anymore. Who are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Bummer. All right, Parker, speaking of your Red Sox and Fenway, as much fun as we had this week for All-Star break, really the fun just begins, because I know you and me get really excited when we start talking about trade deadline, and we alluded to this a couple weeks ago. This has been the craziest season when you look at the teams that are performing, the teams that are right on the edge trying to get one of those last playoff spots. The races are going to be tight from here on out in most of these races. Parker, before we start talking about some specific teams, what do you make of the just the landscape right now and where we're at going into the deadline?
It is anyone's game. And this is partially a product of the fact that we let everybody and their brother into the playoffs, which, look,
yeah.
I've been a fan of the expanded playoffs ever since it started. I thought it was great during COVID, and I thought it was great as we move forward with a more expanded playoffs as opposed to before COVID. And I think that it provides a lot of fans more reason to watch later in the season. Talk about, you know, what is the most compelling time to watch baseball? It is during the playoffs. But what is the most that what is the time where baseball is the most competed with in terms of viewership? When the NFL starts, which is also during the playoffs. So the more playoff baseball you could give us, the better. I genuinely believe that this is a really good direction for MLB to have gone. But that also turns into what we have now seen over the last few years of this expanded playoff format of every team feels like they're in it. Even teams with losing records right now truly believe that they are in it. When we look at the standings in the wild card, like there are teams that could truly, truly make a run that do have losing records at this moment. The Texas Rangers are one game below 500 and they are 3.5 games out of a playoff spot. Now, say what you want, whether that's good for the game or not. It's good for the fan. There are fans in Arlington, Texas that live and die by their Rangers that are still watching every pitch of every game because they are still in the hunt. And I think that that is invaluable as an experience for a fan that you are trying to develop and bring into the later stages of fandom, like, you know, young kids who are watching compelling baseball later into the season and later into the season. If you want to compete with the NFL, if you want to compete with the NFL, you want to keep those eyes on those TVs and keep those MLB TV subscriptions going and incentivize MLB to actually figure out what's wrong with their blackout system and make this a better experience for the fan. This is the way to do it. I truly, truly believe that. So it's anyone's game. That's the answer to your question that you asked me, but it's anywhere we can go. We can go anywhere from here.
Yeah, we really can. And I'm with you. The expanded playoffs is great. I love that more teams get in. I love how tight the races are all the way to the end. But more importantly, I just love that multiple fan bases get in on the fun, right? That just happens more than ever had before. Like, baseball is a better product when more engaged, when there's fan bases that are more engaged, just full stop. So it makes me think about these standings as I look at this, and I kind of see teams kind of falling into two categories, and I want to kind of dive into it. So there's the teams that, there's no option. The fire is under your ass. You need to add at this trade deadline. Time is ticking. You must do something. There's teams that, like, red flag, code red, we need to do something. And
name
then there's
one
teams
of those
that are
me.
Like the Cubs.
The Yankees.
That was going to be my second one. So let's talk about those teams first, because I think those are the most interesting.
We'll finish your point, because there are multiple factions of teams here. Well, you can go ahead and finish like what those are.
So the multiple factions of teams are the code red teams. You need to do something now because you can't afford to miss a playoff spot. There's group two that I would call the teams that, if they actually want to invest the money and reinforce their team, they can make a deep playoff run, the Red Sox. And then three teams that are like, we're going to wait and see until the day before the deadline, kind of where we're at. And then we'll decide if we're going to pedal the metal after that, kind of the mid-tier teams. So I want to start with those code red teams. You mentioned the Cubs and the Yankees, I think, are the two code red teams where they cannot afford to waste their roster, to waste time. They need to get in the playoffs and they may need to make a deep run. So which do you want to start with first?
The Cubs or the Yankees? I'm more familiar with the Yankees, so let's do the Cubs. You can have your moment, and I'll talk later.
Okay, so the Cubs right now are, folks, only a game ahead of the Brewers in the NL Central. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. The Brewers pitching staff is one of the best in baseball right now. All of them have either slightly above 3 or sub 3 ERAs, and their offense is sneaky good. Whereas you have a Cubs team that, while their offense has been very good, there are still many question marks in their rotation and deeper into their bullpen. And we all know what's the thing that can kill you in the dog days of summer and into a playoff series: pitching, pitching, pitching. And they just do not have playoff caliber pitching. And this may be, Cubs, your last year with a Kyle Tucker. And it's the last year on Jed Hoyer's contract. There's a million other ands. But this team right now can't really afford to not go all in at the trade deadline and risk losing the spot to a very hot Brewers team that is not going away.
So I agree with you to a certain extent. I also think that there's something here that we're not considering, and that's that the Cubs have less to lose than I think is perceived, because if they are overtaken by the Brewers, where do they fall? Well, they fall to the top wildcard spot. Right now, that top wildcard spot is 4 games up on the last wildcard spot. And say what you want about 4 games, but as we play, like we play one more month of baseball, and 4 games becomes a mountain to climb once we enter September, because a really good, and this is completely anecdotal, but it's actually super effective if you think about it. There is the guy who runs, he's basically like the face of Nesson in terms of Red Sox broadcasting. He is not a play-by-play guy. He does a lot of on-field stuff, and he does a lot of pre and post. Tom Caron is just a career Nesson guy, and he has this little algorithm that he likes to whip out every single year after the All-Star break. And it's that if you are as many games up or back, if the difference that you are either trying to defend or overcome is equal to the amount of weeks of baseball left to play, you can start to feel a little comfortable. So sure, a 4-game lead in the wild card, once we enter the month of September, becomes a mountain to climb for every team trying to overtake you. And so I think if the Cubs are division or bust, absolutely red flag, you know, 5-alarm fire. We are buying at this trade deadline. We are trying to win now, trying to entice Tucker to you know, sign a contract, and try, and Jed Hoyer's trying to keep his job. And I think those are the factors that really lead into them needing to win the division more so than just make the playoffs. But as far as a Cubs fan, if I don't have a ton of loyalty to a Kyle Tucker or to a Jed Hoyer, and I'm watching Pete Crow Armstrong become one of the best players in baseball, and my team has a significant lead in the wild card, I think I'm okay. Not happy, but okay with being pretty set in a playoff spot at this particular point in the season. We have seen way crazier stuff than a 5.
Yeah.
Right now, their cumulative lead over a not having a playoff spot is 5 games. We have seen way crazier stuff than a 5-game lead disappearing over the course of 2 months. But the further into the season we get, that 5-game lead gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I mean, no, I see what you mean. Having interacted with Cubs fans here where I'm at in the sweet city of Chicago and Chicago suburbs, I could tell you that Cubs fans are concerned about a couple things, as they have been the last couple of years. Number one, this offense has not been a Chicago Cubs offense for the last 2 years. This is the first year that this offense has exploded as it should. Two, this is the first time that they've had a true MVP caliber player in Tucker in some time and actually perform at that level. And three, I think, like you say, it's not necessarily by sheer mathematics and getting in about the division. Where I get concerned is you can get in, but are you wearing the best tux to the dance? And I don't think they are. I don't know that their staff can compete with these other pitching staffs deep to make a playoff run. That's where the concern is. I think that's what you're trying to fix at the deadline. Not getting in. They're going to get in. Regardless, they're going to get in. They're not going to get far, though, when they get in with the roster as currently constructed. I just don't think
so. Not with the pitching they have. And also, you made a good point that their offense is definitely firing on all cylinders, and this is a super, super potent offense. But let's look and see at what are the things that they have going for them that make this offense so spectacular. And it is a lot of, I don't want to say wishy-washy, but I'm having trouble coming up with another term. But I'm not counting on Pete Crow Armstrong past any season but this one. I love Pete Crow Armstrong. Him and Bobby Wood Jr., two of my favorite players in baseball, probably outside of the Red Sox, my top two favorite players in baseball. And I love the way they play the game. But I have watched many a center fielder have a season much like Pete Crow Armstrong and then really fall to earth the next season. Because when your play is based on athleticism, athleticism only plays so far as you are able to adjust to the pitching that you are facing. Pete Crow Armstrong's always going to be an elite defender, but I could totally see him having a league average offensive season next season. And I say that based on watching Jacoby Ellsbury hit 30 home runs and then fall off the face of the planet. Watching Jaren Duran have a 9-WAR season last year, have finished fifth in MVP voting, and now have a sub 800 OPS this season. And like, I've seen this happen. Jackie Bradley Jr. was a very, very, he was a above average offensive player. He won the Golden Spikes Award in college. He was incredible. And then turned into just a glove over the course of his career. And I know I just named a bunch of Red Sox, but this happens. This happens very frequently throughout Major League Baseball history. And then look at the other person that's really firing on all cylinders for this Cubs offense that we didn't think really would, Michael Busch. I'm not counting on shit from him outside of this season. So I think your point is very valid. You cannot count on this offense, or I cannot count on this offense moving forward. So where do you have to lean on? Your pitching. And it's just not there. There's not enough pitching to get this team anywhere past a one round exit in the playoffs.
No, there's not. And this is where the depth piece of this matters. We've talked about the Dodgers so much in our conversations because they have the depth in their pitching and they have the depth with their position players. And it seems like they could have seven pitchers on the DL, on the DL throwback.
Wow, what time?
They have there seven, we are. Right. Holy crap, that came, what was it, 2005? And they can have seven pitchers on the IL and still have a full rotation. And it just blows my mind. Like, I'm not saying you have to be that, like, that's extreme. No. They have the money to do that. However, there are still significant holes. Like you said, don't count on a full season of that production from Busch or Crow Armstrong. Right now you have Vidal Brujan at third. Like, mm-hmm. you need to fill that third base spot, for example. Like, you need to bring in another bench bat. You need at least a top-tier starting pitcher, maybe even a second, and a guy for the mm-hmm. bullpen. Like, this is a large shopping list for this team.
Do you consider Miguel Vargas to be a cornerstone player in the White Sox organization at this point?
I believe that that is to be determined.
Okay, because I think that the White Sox stand to
make the decision.
I think the White Sox stand to make a lot of really good moves at the this trade deadline, or at least one significantly big one. If they shop Miguel Vargas around, especially to the Cubs or a team like them, and get some pitching or get. Like, you, because honestly, when you look at it, like, you got to Chase Meidroth, you got Colson Montgomery coming up in the system. I think that the Cubs are pretty set in terms of the infield. So you trade away a Luis Robert and a Miguel Vargas, and all of a sudden you get an outfielder or like an arm or two, maybe a lottery ticket prospect or three. And like, oh my God, the White Sox completely have changed the face of their franchise and their trajectory in the next 5 to 6 years. That's the kind of guy I want on my team if I'm the Cubs, because that's an achievable target. Like, there are very few potent offensive players that are achievable targets going into this particular trade deadline because everybody feels like they're in it. So you have to go shopping to the teams that really either have an excess. Like, again, I use my Red Sox because there are like 75 outfielders on this team and most of them are pretty good offensively. That's an excess. You have to deal from a place of strength if you're going to continue to build your franchise. And I think the White Sox, while still, like, I'm not trying to give false hope, the White Sox are not necessarily a good baseball team at this point, but they could very, very much improve their situation if they take the assets they have that are not going to factor in the next 5 years, really, because I don't see Miguel Vargas being anything more than what he is at this very moment for the next 5 years. But who Miguel Vargas is right now can definitely bring a lot to a lineup that needs some help.
Yeah, I mean, he could, and I do think that's within the realm of possibility. Like I said, I don't think the Sox are married to him. There is some depth there in the organization for the White Sox, and I think your point is valid in that the Cubs, and really, quite frankly, any team in the trade deadline this year, especially this year when teams haven't decided if they're really buying or selling, you got to get creative. You just do. Like, maybe the Cubs call up the Pirates for a maybe. Mm-hmm. You go to the Diamondbacks and say, hey, I know you're talking to people about Eugenio Suarez. Give me that guy. You know, like,
oh my God, he's going to go for so much.
A good fit. That would be a really good fit for the Cubs. And I personally don't think you have to give up too much for a Eugenio Suarez at the end of the day.
No, because he's a free agent at the end of the year, isn't he? At the end of the year anyway, isn't he? Yeah.
Right.
And then
right.
like Josh Naylor is definitely out there too. There's yeah, arms yeah. to be had. Like Merrill Kelly hasn't been talked about a ton. Definitely mm-hmm. going to probably be traded. Zach Gallen in much similar boat. We still have heard next to nothing out of San Diego about whether they're going to part ways with Dylan Cease and Michael King. But I just don't see why an organization in the situation that they are wouldn't get rid of one or both of them. And like,
yes.
there's pitching to be had. Joe Ryan is hot in the streets right now. And I know the Twins just came out and said that they're not really looking to deal Joe Ryan before the deadline.
Yeah.
I just don't think that there's – I don't think that you're in a position in Minnesota to turn down a good package for Joe Ryan. Like, I think he's going to be a guy that moves. So there's pitching to be had. The Cubs need pitching. And you don't have enough offensive weapons to truly trade away offensive weapons. So maybe they work a three-team deal. Maybe they do call up the other Chicago team and get Miguel Vargas on the – on. You know, on the block and figure something out. Cause you're right. These Cubs, they do need a lot. They are maintaining a division lead. They've basically had it wire to wire at this point. It might actually be wire to wire. And
it might.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot to be said and we could go on for a long time about a Cubs team that, you know, you and I have been very interested in this year, but work needs to be done. There's no 100% clear cut way of looking at what work needs to be done. But if they needed established closer that won a World Series with them, I would be okay with parting ways with Aroldis Chapman at this point.
Ooh, reunion which on the north side. Not a bad idea.
Which I know sounds weird because I know I want the Red Sox to make the playoffs, but I truly think that that would be one of the bigger fleeces of the trade deadline because I don't think Aroldis Chapman has an entire playoff run worth of baseball left in him, but he's performing so well right now that it's kind of hard not to be tempted if you're a team who needs relief pitching. I find Aroldis Chapman intriguing very much so at this trade deadline.
Let's circle back to that because I have questions as it relates to just the Red Sox generally. Before we get there, though, the Yankees are the other kind of code red flag team. And Parker, when I look at the Yankees, like just the sheer numbers, you know, when you look at their relief pitching, their relief core is the biggest issue. They're 20th in baseball in ERA, their relief pitching, and they haven't been able to stop games, hold games, save games, you name it. But outside of that, the starting rotation, third in WHIP, seventh in ERA. They're hitting fifth in average, first in OPS. Like there's something about them that is off. And I don't, maybe it's just that they're not coming up in big spots. The clutch gene just doesn't seem to be there. I don't know what it is, but they have let the Blue Jays surpass them. They're letting the Red Sox creep up on them and they're not running away like we thought they did. What is the problem?
So am I crazy to think that the Yankees have felt like this for like almost a decade now where it's like, yeah, they're the Yankees. Yeah. So we'll give them kind of the benefit of the doubt. But basically in the entire Aaron Boone era, it's like a team with glaring weaknesses that has found a way to be successful and to win games and make it to a World Series and always make the playoffs like they always do. But there's definitely something missing here. And maybe it's because they don't have Gerrit Cole. Maybe it's because they're very reliant on two starting pitchers and then whoever the fuck they can get from the stands with the jersey on to throw the ball the other three spots in the rotation. Maybe it's the fact their bullpen has sort of underperformed this year. Maybe it's the fact that their left fielder, Jason Dominguez, who's been kind of their like marquee prospect of the last few years. He's on like his 17th rookie season, it feels like. But like Jason Dominguez has carrying a .250 batting average and a sub 800 OPS right now. Not the kind of bat that we thought he was going to be this year. Like what? They finally DFA'd DJ LeMahieu. Jazz Chisholm has only really hit home runs this year. There's a lot of things about this team that are just like, first of all, how did you win as many games as you have?
Yeah, right.
Why did somebody not catch you earlier? And what are you going to do to fix this team?
I don't, and I hate coming back to it, but it becomes another kind of depth issue because I don't know that I look at this team and see anything glaring other than yes, you like everyone else should add at least two bullpen arms, get at least a number three starter in there to fortify the rotation, maybe a bench bat. But like, again, it's just, you said it perfectly. It's a team that like they're the Yankees, but they're like slightly more than mid and that wins the day for them. I don't know why that is, but yeah. I'm here to tell you don't rest on your laurels, Yankees, just like the Cubs can't rest on their laurels with the Brewers behind them. The Blue Jays or Red Sox, I think, have a real potential for the rest of the season to just keep getting better. And I do think it is more likely that the Jays and the Red Sox get better over the next 3 months than the Yankees get better. I just think.
Is there a move that would, because there's a move that I have in mind and it's nothing spectacular, that would actually kind of put the Yankees over the edge for me in terms of being very competitive for the division? And it's Eugenio Suarez. If they could bring his bat in and really firm up this lineup and have a guy to protect Aaron Judge in the lineup, or even have Aaron Judge protect him, I honestly think that maybe Aaron Judge is more valuable in the protector role rather than the protectee, because I would still rather pitch to Eugenio Suarez than Aaron Judge. I'll still just walk Aaron Judge with the bases loaded to get to Eugenio Suarez. But I think that if you were to bring that bat onto this team, that it does a lot. You know, they could play him at third base. He would probably do just fine there. I think that's a big time move. But you mentioned that every team should probably be looking at bringing in like a number three quality starter. Well, the Yankees need two of those guys, because I would not feel comfortable bringing Max Fried, fresh off of a brand new contract, and a Carlos Rodon who struggled to stay healthy throughout his entire career. Really, you do need a righty at some point, because there's a lot of really good right-handed hitters that you're going to be playing up against in the playoffs. I think that they actually need two starting pitchers, because we always talk about the three-man starting rotation, but like, you do need four. You don't need five, really, but you do need four, because there will be times when you need that fourth guy to make a start over the course of a longer playoff series. And I just don't count on either of those two big lefties in Rodon and Fried staying healthy over the course of the rest of the season.
You know, my issue, though, with them is I don't think this gets talked about enough, is the Cubs, if they were going to make a move for some quality bats or some kind of top of the rotation pitchers, they have the prospect capital to do that. The Yankees
don't.
Not that strong of a system, guys. I mean, I don't know where they're pulling guys from. They don't have as much capital as they used to by any stretch of the imagination.
No, and I haven't seen them listed as a particularly strong draft class this year either. I didn't. All I listened to was Red Sox prospect stuff, because nobody has the bandwidth, I think, to follow everybody's prospect lists. But I wait for people to tell me what to think about those. But I agree with you. I don't think that the Yankees have a ton of capital to deal with. I think you're looking at cash trades. I think you're looking at reclamation projects, salary dumps. Like, you know, Fernando Tatis, I would actually like, might go postal if Fernando Tatis became a Yankee. But that's kind of the, like, if they're just willing to trade away Spencer Jones and 3, 4, 5 lottery tickets and then take the entire contract of Tatis, like, maybe that's on the table. But I don't know. Here's the deal. If you need pitchers, if you need anything like on the pitching side of the house, I think the Padres are the stop that you need to be making. So maybe Michael King, you know, maybe he comes back to New York.
Yeah.
Maybe a Dylan Cease. Like, though, I still cannot believe how little buzz there is around those guys, because I think that there's a price that you could pay to get those guys on your team this year. And if both of them somehow were to make their way to the Yankees, I think that that is just, they become like a World Series favorite to me. If they have two more starting pitchers and then like an Eugenio Suarez, they become a World Series favorite in my.
Yeah, that's not a stretch whatsoever. Like I said, like we both said, I mean, I think this team is not out by any stretch. However, they just need that little extra something. What that is to be determined. Parker, I really want to talk about this mid-tier, and this is probably the last group we talk about, because quite frankly, I don't care about everyone else. But I care about the mid-tier teams. I care about these teams that, if they choose to invest and really build around what they have, they could make a surprising run. And no one is more so in that category than the Red Sox, I think.
I would argue differently. I actually think there's a team that's more so than that, but I want to talk about the Red Sox, so we're going to do that first. The Red Sox have won 10 games, and the position they currently hold, which is a playoff spot and 3 games out of the division, is truly and only and solely on the back of that 10-game winning streak that happened to coincide with a slightly weaker stretch of play from the Yankees and from the Blue Jays. Like, granted, there's nothing as strong as going 10-0 in your last 10. Everything's going to be weaker than that, but they were able to make up a good amount of ground, and they're starting to see a lot of really good play from a lot of really solid young players. Here's the secret, though. Seydon Rafael is not actually an MVP candidate until he does it for a couple years, so it's much like PCA, I'm not willing to bet my team's success on Seydon Rafael, you know, being the guy that he's been over the last month to 5-6 weeks.
Right.
And I think that the Red Sox really, really need a number two starter to come in here and start shoving if this is what they're going to try to accomplish in making a playoff run. I think if they're going to try to make a run of the division, you need a starter and you need like two bullpen pieces, because the Red Sox bullpen is super gassed and was super gassed coming into the break. Now, luckily, a part of that 10-game win streak were two gems by Brian Bello and by Garrett Crochet, who both managed to pitch complete games, Crochet pitching a complete game shutout. So the bullpen got not just the All-Star break, but like an All-Star break and a half leading into the break. So guys who were super gassed, like a Greg Weissert and a bunch of the more used guys in that bullpen, I think are going to be very formidable coming out of the break. But we saw the wheels fall off of this Red Sox team last year, basically entirely because the bullpen forgot how to pitch in the second half. I think we're in a better position this year, but not too much better. So I would really love to see the Red Sox go out there. I don't think the starting pitcher is like as dire as definitely getting some guys who can take some innings out of the bullpen. I think the Red Sox have enough starting pitching depth in a guy like Richard Fitz, in the Kyle Harrison that they just got from the Giants. Even I think Jordan Hicks makes a start at some point in this year. I don't think that he's just going to be a bullpen arm for them. I think the starting pitching's there, but you need guys who can go out there, like maybe even a multi-inning guy to just, maybe even just one of those, what do they call it? Like the white flag pitcher where it comes out there and just finishes out dead games. Maybe one of those guys, because they have a lot of value on a Red Sox team that doesn't have a ton of those guys and a bullpen that's severely overtaxed. I think the offense is there. The offense is, if it's not with these guys, like I'm not willing to lose at bats for Roman Anthony and Marcelo Meyer to bring anybody in to play their positions. So
correct. Correct.
I need the additions to happen in the bullpen and the starting rotation, and to continue to hope these young guys perform. So don't sell the farm. Invest in what you have by getting lower cost bullpen guys. And if there's a package out there that allows for a Joe Ryan or something like that, I'm willing to trade away. I've said it so many times, you know, Willier and or a Jaron Duran to make that happen. I just think that you need to focus on the bullpen more so.
Absolutely. I'll add one more to the list that I don't think is crucial, but I would just love to see it. Can we get them a damn regular first baseman, please? Like, I mean, when's the last time you guys had a regular first baseman? Eric Hosmer, Adrian Gonzalez? Like, what are we doing?
I don't want it. I don't want it.
Why?
I think that the platoon of Abraham Toro and Romy Gonzalez has been better than any first baseman in baseball, save for like four or five. The platoon of those two players, Toro against righties and Romy Gonzalez against lefties, has been a 900 plus OPS as a combination. And Romy Gonzalez is not just a first baseman. He's played second. He has played third. And I love the utility from him. Toro's played some third too. So I love the flexibility in this lineup right now. I'm genuinely willing to ride with those guys.
Well, that's the key thing. Ride with them. That's not a long-term solution. There's no
way. No, it's not. No, no, no. In the offseason, we need to get a first baseman.
Yeah. Yeah. What's Bobby Dalbec doing these days?
I don't know, but I'm willing to bring him onto the roster. He's at, you know what he's doing? He's hitting nukes. I saw like a clip of him in AAA. Yeah, hitting an absolute nuke in AAA. I think he's on like the Storm Chasers right now. I don't remember, but he's in professional ball. He's playing AAA baseball.
Good for him. Good for him. Big fan. Bobby Dalbec stands here.
Love me some Bobby Dalbec. Most handsome man in baseball.
Parker, you said there was another team on your mind, of this kind of team that needs some pieces and that could make a good run. Who's on your mind?
I think that the Milwaukee Brewers are actually in like five alarm fire must add right now mode, because we always talk about how they're the Rays of the National League. I think that this is a team that you cannot count on this level of success year in and year out. It's when all the pieces fit together, and that is a very hard formula to repeat. So I think you take the success that they have right now and you build on it. You add yourself an arm, you ride Jacob Mizorowski, you ride a lineup that's could be better. And I think you supplement it again with like a Eugenio Suarez, Luis Robert were to go to the. And I think that they need to supplement that with some pitching for sure.
Man, I mean, you're definitely not wrong. That is super intriguing. I have to ask you, Actually, I'm trying to find it here because I just want to laugh. I just want to laugh. Who has batted in 16 plate appearances with the Brewers? He's batting .429. Would you happen to know who that is?
29. 16
plate appearances over the last week with the Brewers. He's batting .429. He has a...
is it Yelly?
No. It's my old friend, Andrew Vaughn, who, of course, leaves the White Sox and has found a way to make a good contact all of a sudden. What the hell is this? What's going on?
I don't know, man. I think there's something in the water in Milwaukee, genuinely. I think this team, it's one of those, like boys club type teams where it's like the vibes get pretty high and they ride those vibes for a while. I think it's a super constructive clubhouse. They got good leadership there and like a Rhys Hoskins and a Christian Yelich. And I think when a guy like Andrew Vaughn, no offense, leaves the organization in Chicago where he really felt like he was beating his head up against the wall in terms of I need to be the guy and I can't be the guy, but I can be a guy. And I think the role of role player for a guy like Vaughn, I think that's his optimal fitting. I don't know that he was ever going to be a true cornerstone, like corner infield bat.
No.
And I think this is the perfect opportunity for him to get out there and show that he's got merit. Like, we always knew he had merit. And I think it's just kind of putting a player in the position to succeed with a lot of people who have really high energy around him.
Yeah, that's definitely it. That whole not being the guy but a guy, it's a whole psychology. It's a whole psychology thing. It matters. It really equates to the same reason the change of scenery thing matters.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think back, weird poll, but I think back when the Boston Celtics had Big Baby Davis out there, and he was a really good six man, but if you put him in the starting lineup, he stunk. You know, I think a role player and a guy who can be a role player is a different breed than a guy who can be a starter, especially in baseball. The ability to come off the bench, the ability to not play every day and still stay on your A game is so valuable. Mm-hmm. And I think Andrew Vaughn might be just one of those guys who's built for that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Parker, we're going to be talking more about the trade deadline. Well, I guess I'll be talking about the trade deadline solo over the next couple of weeks because this is, I think, the last show, right, for a couple of weeks for you?
Yeah, I'll be back. I won't be back in town until like after the first week of August. So,
okay.
Really long string of making it to every single episode, but a lot of really important family. I live very far from my family. My job takes me away from home and I get to just kind of sit there and watch my parents be grandparents over the next few weeks. And I'm just going to kind of soak that in for a while.
I love that. Good on you. Lord knows I missed an episode here or there. So I suppose you can take some time off.
I put my PTO in like 6 months ago.
It was approved. Don't worry. Needless to say, you're stuck with me for the next couple of weeks, guys. We're going to be kind of focusing when you're stuck with me on the trade deadline. We're going to be tracking over the next couple of weeks, and we'll talk about it as it happens in the next two shows. But before we get out of here tonight, final word, Parker, what's your last word?
Keep your eyes open. Anthony and I are super restless and can never be content doing just one thing. And we're kind of stewing on a few ideas that we've been working on and are super excited to just yap a little bit more. Big yappers over here, and we love doing it.
Man, that's a good one. That didn't even cross my mind to make that my last word, but I'll piggyback on that and say that Parker and I talk about probably more not about baseball than baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to kind of share more of that. Obviously, Parker and I have grown to be really good friends, and we talk about a variety of things, and our interests are quite varied, and we're not going to let that slip by, I don't think. So,
yeah, I find it interesting too, just a little peek behind the curtain. Like, you and I, when we jumped on this show, had maybe been on like two Zoom calls together ever. And this has turned into more than just obviously being on a couple Zoom calls, and has turned into something that I think we're both really excited about developing. And I think we have something, we have more topics we'd like to talk about. And you probably will not have to go far to find it.
Love it. Love it. My last word is going to be baseball related. And it's that on Tuesday, Parker, I'm excited. I'm heading to Wrigley to watch Cubs v. Royals. Very excited. Ooh,
that's pretty cool.
Yes. It's going to be good going over there. Looking forward to seeing the Cubs in action. Looking forward to seeing PCA and then Bobby Witt Jr. It's going to be a fun night.
Yeah, dude, that's going to be – that's a combination of some really rock star players. I'm really jealous of you to see all that.
I was going to say, I'm going to see, you, like you said, two of your favorite non-Red Sox players. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, have fun. Take pictures.
Heck yeah, man. All right, folks. We will catch you next week here on Late Night Baseball. Take care, everybody.